Hi, everybody. I'm here with Sarah Reed. Sarah is the lead psychedelic research therapist at Imperial College London. She spent her early career examining how culture influences how we diagnose and treat mental illness. Sarah's prior research work includes participation as a study therapist for a phase two MDMA clinical study of PTSD, sponsored by MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. As a mental health futurist, Sarah is curious about using digital technology to support mental wellness. So, Sarah, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So, Sarah, your work spans lots of different areas, and one of them is equity and ethics. And I'd like to start with a question that I know is a little bit big as a question, but as the psychedelic renaissance keeps going, who, in your view, who is at risk of being left behind in that renaissance right now?
Yeah, I'll say in the research world, people of color are largely being left behind. If you just look at demographic data, that there's typically an overrepresentation of white folks involved in psychedelic-assisted research and underrepresentation of people of color. Something that feels quite fresh in my mind about disparities in psychedelic research is the EEG headset. And something that I learned is that the EEG headset doesn't, how do I say? The adapters are not, were not designed for textured hair. So people with the hair like mine, curly coily hair, that if you have that hair type, then you can't do the EEGs ac accurately or adequately. And because our research center is quite neuroimaging focused, and we need that data, and that's that data is usually a primary outcome for a lot of our studies, that if we enroll a participant who has textured hair and they can't do the EEG reading because of their hair, they can likely be excluded from the trial. And so it's like even the design and the setup, the machines, the tools that we use for these trials have also are unintentionally racist and exclusionary. And thankfully, there are a group of folks in the state specifically called SIVO, SEVO, who have created apparatuses and adapters to address this issue, which we hopefully will be using at some point in the future for our future studies. But that's just one example that comes to mind that, yeah, we as a field of psychedelic therapy and research, that usually there's different demographics of folks that are thought about as an afterthought, that they aren't considered in the design and the at the beginning of creating a research trial.
Yeah, that's kind of crazy when I hear that. It's something that people probably don't think about a lot. But so, that's something that's quite, I suppose, overt and technical and very important. But I imagine that there's also a lot of implicit barriers for people, communities of color, but also probably, different religious communities, etc., for whom coming into that psychedelic space is perhaps alienating or just not something that's sort of that they would know where to find access to. I mean, so what are some of those more implicit kind of assumptions that are kind of in the field right now?
So I will answer this question by telling my story, which is a personal story about, yeah, why I talk so much about the importance of cultural sensitivity and culturally responsible care. So let's go back to 2017, where I was a newbie, still am a newbie in the psychedelic research world, and I was I first participated in the MDMA therapy for PTSD research trial sponsored by MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, and this was in the States. And part of the MAPS therapist training included an optional study where therapists could take MDMA in a one-time clinical setting. Now, I was someone at the time who had taken psychedelics and other drugs before, so I knew what it meant to alter my consciousness. I also knew the guides who would be supporting me in my journey. So I really went into that research trial as a participant quite comfortable, if not too comfortable. And so, yeah, this is a healthy volunteer trial that I took as a therapist in training. And then, yeah, we'll spare the details of the ins and outs of what that trial was like. But if folks are interested, I have talked about this a lot in podcasts, or I literally wrote about it, I've danced about it. So we can send some links for folks. And if there's a description below, we can add some links there about that. But for purposes of this conversation, I'll share that in my MDMA dosing experience, I experienced a common subjective effect of a psychedelic, which is oneness, feeling connected to myself and my therapist. And I was in this space of divine love, divine connection, where nothing was separate. I really saw the connection in all things. And I am articulating this to my therapist in a way that where I was sharing that I'm beyond these aspects of who people told me who I was or who I had to be. And one of my therapists says, "You sound white, like racially white." And I say, "No, I don't." And then another therapist laughs and says, "Yeah, like all lives matter." And so in that moment, not only did these two guides dismiss me in this expanded state of consciousness, but I also knew that it wasn't psychologically safe for me to be there. And so I completed that dosing session, and honestly was very challenging, but eventually I found my ground. And then I was really asking myself, like, what is this field that I am getting into? Because if this is happening to me and I'm a therapist who's going to be holding space for folks in research trials, what are participants been exposed to, participants of color specifically? And so I share my story as an illustration of there are a lot of unconscious biases that I think are woven into the development of psychedelic therapy research and treatment. And these biases can play out in really psychologically harmful ways. And unless there is a constant interrogation or just a real examination of why are we doing the things that we do in the psychedelic therapy space, I think that we are going to continue to perpetuate harms against folks that are most vulnerable. And so, yeah, maybe I'll pause there for now.
Yeah, no, thank you for sharing that. I mean, it's painful to listen to, right? Because it's so wrong in many ways. Like, you know, as someone I run retreats for healthy well, let's say healthy neurotics is what I'm qualified to work with, which I think is a really funny phrase. We're all healthy neurotics, right? But you know, so there's this sense of like, I'm trying to put myself in the shoes of like ever saying that, and it feels really off for a bunch of reasons. Also, there's a really political charge to saying all lives matter in any space, right? And especially when someone's in a vulnerable space. So, you know, that's yeah, I mean, it does really illustrate the need for a much deeper understanding. And I'm wondering what your experience has been like going from the US, where there's a different sort of different demographics and different politics, and then moving to the UK and working at Imperial College, where you know the UK has a kind of similar issues, but also kind of a different, you know, there's different communities here, there's different people coming through the trials, or maybe there's not different people coming through the trials. I'm wondering what that shift has been like for you to kind of continue that mission over here.
I would say that I am still piecing through the differences as I am just a fresh 1 year and some change into the research he world here at Imperial College. And from what I've noticed from, maybe a systems and a participant level is that it's similar demographics, it's similar politics, it's just maybe a different comfort with talking about the things. And by comfort, I mean, in my experience in the States, there is more, it's more normalized to talk about race, gender, sexuality, and the intersections of these pieces with mental health. Whereas here, I feel like there is more of a discomfort with talking about different aspects of identity because people are, that whiteness is really normalized here, right? I tell folks all the time that I'm in the land of the OG colonizers because, I mean, that is the truth, and you can still feel the remnants of it from when you're walking out in the street or when you're having conversations with people that, particularly in London, that everybody's in the hustle and bustle and a bit disconnected even from their bodies. They're constantly on the go to the next thing. Whereas yeah, depending on where you're at in the States, you still have that same level of hustle and bustle and disembodiment. But particularly in the South, that the pace is a little different. Or again, in conversations around identity, there's more, it's more normalized, and there we can cover different territory here. Whereas I find here, we are talking about race, gender, sexuality in like the 101. Like, what is the difference between race and ethnicity? How can we, do super small, simple things like, just being more inclusive on a demographic questionnaire by asking pronouns or by adding a variety of, or adding a different categorizations of sexuality as opposed to just a select few. So it's like these are just small, small things that I notice here where it feels like, yeah, we're in London, I'll say specifically. Yeah, I find that there's a lot more work to be done than in the States where it's more normalized to talk about these things.
Yeah, that's really interesting to hear. You know, I've lived here for in London for about 14 years, but I'm half Irish and half German, so I moved from Dublin, which it's always struck me like that the UK, I wonder partly what's going on. The UK hasn't really yet grappled with its colonial history. There hasn't really been a proper grappling with it in the same way. You know, if I look at Germany, growing up in Germany, you know, as a child, you're really taught about the horrors of World War II, that Germany's done quite a good job of being like, this happened, we're trying to deal with it, you know, with its own flaws, doesn't do it perfectly. But, and then Ireland has the history of being colonized by England for 700 years, but there's not really a reckoning with that or a reckoning with the whole history. So I do wonder if that, you know, that's also playing into it. Also, there's a kind of thing, which is also true in Ireland, of, you know, things being unsaid. You know, that in the culture, the politeness cultures, like British or Japanese culture, like a lot is unsaid under the surface. For makes for great comedy, but it's doesn't make for great speaking to what's under the surface of things, right? It's a tricky thing. So it's Yeah, it's strange coming from, switching between cultures, I would imagine. So you mentioned something in that which I wanted, which flashed up for me, which was embodiment and being disembodied. And I wonder if you could speak a bit about embodiment as it relates to psychedelic journeying, psychedelic therapy, because not that many people have talked about it yet in the conference, but it's something that I care very much about, and I'm curious to hear your thoughts on. Firstly, maybe what do you mean by embodiment? Because we often have different definitions, and why does it matter?
Okay, so I will get to embodiment and want to get to another E word before we shift gears here, and that is erasure. Like as we talk about the remnants of colonization globally, that what comes up for me and how it relates to psychedelics is the erasure of indigenous influence. That what I see happen in the science and research world is that indigenous influence is treated as something that's historical or not something that's current. And that I've even heard researchers say that, well, if we're not working with psilocybin, or if we're working with MDMA, MDMA is synthesized in the lab, or LSD is synthesized in the lab. So the origins of these substances are different than, say, the origins of psilocybin. And something a medicine teacher once taught me is that you can find psychedelic substances even the derivative of ketamine in nature. You just have to find it in a plant or a fungi. And it's, yeah, it feels important for me as a researcher to not erase the history of plants or people before they come into a lab because, yeah, how we relate to these substances has a direct impact on how we show up and hold space. For people when using these substances. So to go to embodiment, how do I define embodiment? I would say embodiment is the ability to be present with what is. And for me, that doesn't just mean, being present with the more desirable things like love, joy, happiness, peace, or embodiment doesn't mean that you're just, tranquil and grounded, all the time. Embodiment means also being comfortable with your edges or being okay with disappointment or feeling embarrassed. It means, like embracing the being awkward. It's what does it mean to be fully present with this unique expression of my human existence in this moment, and seeing how that changes. And what I've witnessed in the realm of psychedelic therapy when it comes to embodiment is that participants can often come into research trials or enroll in research trials in a disembodied way. That they can often be quite cognitive, wanting to separate themselves from the problem, wanting to get rid of whatever sensation, thought, feeling is coming up. And they're quite consumed and immersed with the thing that they're trying to separate from. And what I've seen psychedelics do is offer folks a different perspective around not just what it is that they're feeling or what they're trying to escape from or get rid of, but who am I alongside of all of these things to offer a third person perspective on what's happening. And what I feel. I also have seen psychedelics help people connect to themselves in a more raw and unfiltered way. So whether it's someone connecting with joy or relaxation for the first time in their lives, or whether it's someone being able to make contact with a deep pain that they've been carrying for decades of their lives. I've seen psychedelics really support folks and not just cognitively, trying to find the solution to or intellectualize what's happening to them, but psychedelics can really support folks in really feeling and moving through whatever is coming up, and to let folks know that it's okay, that there's nothing wrong with them. And that can be quite liberating.
That's a beautiful description, and also I really like that definition of embodiment, because you can't really be, in my view, you can't really be fully present if you're not in your body and you're not feeling what's happening in your body. That's the source of presence. So I'd love to hear a little bit about what research you've been doing at Imperial, and maybe useful to list, which studies you guys have on at the moment, and which ones you are, currently working on, that, and what's coming up in those.
Yes, so I am currently leading the psilocybin for OCD trial, which that trial is on the cusp of its end. So by the time this airs, actually, can I say that, or am I supposed to be speaking like it's
No,
live?
that's all good. That's all good.
Because that's
It's all pre-recorded.
it.
That's okay.
Okay, great. So by the time this will air, that trial will no longer be recruiting participants for. And I've also participated in the psilocybin for chronic pain trial, but that trial has completed. There are a few or a couple healthy volunteer trials, ones with DMT, ones with 5-MeO, a microdosing trial as well. And some exciting trials that are coming up that I will be a part of are the psilocybin for gambling addiction trial and psilocybin for opioid use disorder trial. And I'm particularly excited by or about these two trials because for the first time ever, we are creating a treatment package that is truly culturally sensitive and relevant to the demographics that we're working with. So what does this mean? This means that we are working in collaboration with the National Problem Gambling Clinic to create a therapy package that really fuses both CBT principles and CBT treatment with psychedelic-assisted treatment, which this feels quite important because a lot of what's been talked about in some spaces is okay, we see some efficacy from the research with psychedelics, but how is this going to translate to the medical model? That the psychedelic therapy world has existed as this niche field, but not something that has been integrated into a healthcare system. And so we are exploring that in this trial, with what does it look like to really weave in psychedelic assisted work within a CBT framework. And yeah, so stay tuned to see how that's going to go. But whew, there's a lot that I could say about that, but I'll park that conversation for now. And then, yeah, I'll say for the psilocybin for the opioid use disorder trial, that is also a trial where we are exploring if psilocybin can be effective for folks who have detoxed. And Yeah, I gotta be honest, Alex. One thing that I'm finding frustrating with both of these trials is that we tell folks, psychedelics aren't a magic pill, or, you're not just gonna have one dosing session and be cured. But the design of the trials are literally for one session. And so it's like, it's kind of begging the question of like, okay, like if you're not saying that it's magic pill, but if you're designing trials that you have just one session, then what's the message that you're really conveying here? And yeah, that is, I would say, a tension that I have as a research therapist who is in the psychedelic research world, but also, I'm someone who is constantly thinking about participants who enroll in these trials and the care that the quality of care that they need to, how do I say this? I'm constantly thinking about participant safety in the trial. And I think it's a hard, sometimes it's difficult to balance research demands and timelines with the needs of participants.
Yeah, and I think that must be a difficult thing because, I've spoken to lots of people who work in clinical trials who've echoed something similar. And, having been a healthy volunteer on a clinical trial was an interesting experience at Imperial, for a very different reason, more metaphysical exploration for me. And so, the DMT extended stay trial, but there is a way in which the clinical trial model itself, no matter how many ways you spin it, is got a there's a kind of, I think brutality is maybe too strong a word, but I'll use that word. It is looking to reduce as many different variables as possible to determine what's the thing that's actually working. And some of those variables are human. Like, for example, I've talked to people about, like, okay, why not give them a breathwork session beforehand, like we do in our retreats, so that people have an experience of an altered state and they feel more grounded, they have more resources. Like, yeah, we can't do that because that might skew the results because we don't know if it's the breathwork or the psilocybin that helped. And that's an example where it's like, yeah, but there's a very good chance it's going to help them and maybe even be more effective because they'll be able to navigate more fully. Those questions I find, I have empathy for you in that position. And yet all the, I've seen so many clinicians do such an incredible job within those constraints as well. And I think part of it's situational of where we find ourselves in the psychedelic renaissance, where it's like nobody really wants to necessarily have the constraints of a clinical trial. I think what most clinicians want is to be working with these medicines in the right way. And so yeah, I don't know, just see if you have any thoughts about that. Yeah.
Yeah. What comes up for me is for us to be in constant interrogation around the ethics of what does it mean to work with psychedelics with vulnerable folks, particularly clinical populations. And I will be the first to say that I don't have the answers, capital T or capital A. And what I do have is just, my hope is that as a field that we continuously question what it is that we do and why we are doing this, because I am, of course, sensitive to, the limitations of research and that, this is not a clinical, this is not clinical work where you can work with someone for months on end, that in a research world, there is a beginning and there is an end. And I can, excuse me, appreciate that. I guess what I am curious about in exploring is like, what are the ethics around supporting someone in a research trial? So, one thing that came up in our, supervision sessions by a therapist named Mahap is that consenting someone to the beginning and the end is really important. That this research trial may, open you up, but there is going to be an end. And we're probably not going to be able to offer you everything that you need given the constraints of this. And so, how can we support you in getting the help that you need post a research trial? That this research work is maybe just the start of you being able to relate to yourself and your symptoms in a different way. But we don't just want to leave you left open to the world to figure it out on your own. And I think that's where I've heard some participants say there's been some failings in the psychedelic research world that participants have this sometimes wonderful connecting experience with being supported by two guides, and then for sessions on end, weeks on end, and then at the end of the trial, it just stops abruptly. And so yeah, how do we continue to support participants in not just from a research way, but like as a field, how do we support participants in more of a systemic way of continuing the ongoing unfolding of their process? And this is where I see models of care, community models of care, models of support being really useful, because there, I don't think it's fair to, first of all, blame fair or useful to blame anyone or to say like, oh, it's a research problem, or the researchers will say, it's not our problem, there's a start and finish. That no, it's like, okay, how can we as a field, if a participant comes through the research or comes into contact with psychedelics through research, then what are other systems of support that they can access post a research trial? And I think that is having a multidisciplinary approach to support folks with psychedelics is a way to make psychedelics more accessible. I don't think that we can overly rely on the medical model, or at well, what I'll say is we can't overly rely on the medical model, that's for sure. And that there may be some folks who may have taken psychedelics recreationally who are maybe looking for one-to-one support or group support. And so to me, it's like, how can we truly come together as a field to really offer diverse support models for folks who are working with psychedelics, whether it's in a self-administered, clinical, recreational, or ceremonial way?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I just went
Yeah.
on a whole bunch of tangents there. So,
Yeah.
welcome
Absolutely. Yeah.
to touch back on any part or
No, that's fantastic. Yeah, there's just one final thing I want to ask you, but also just to mention someone who's come up in the conference, Betty Eisner, who developed Matrix to go along with set, setting, and dose, and Matrix being the people who you go through the journey with, and basically peer support and that kind of wider social field you're in afterwards. I think it's a really essential idea, and it's sort of everyone talks about set, setting, and dose, but forgets community, like peer support. So the last thing I wanted to ask you is, if you had, let's say, infinite funds, what psychedelic research trial would you want to run?
I would want to run, and I don't know if this is research, but this is just what comes to mind, so I'll share. But I would want to use those funds to go home to my home state of Kentucky and get some land and open up a wellness center. And that wellness center will have a wing where folks with severe mental illnesses can come. So whether it's severe trauma, severe OCD, severe depression, where there would be an in-person or an inpatient wing where folks with severe mental illnesses can come and really work with psychedelics. Because what I've seen clinically is that, having some, dosing sessions here and there can be quite useful and help someone to make some progress. But for folks with severe mental illness, that they really need some ongoing support outside of the environments in which they're in. And so at this wellness center, of course, folks will have psychedelic sessions. I would say a combination of low dose psycholytic sessions as well as high dose psychedelic sessions, both individual and group. Folks will also be connected to nature and doing physical activities to really ground them back into a world that's outside of their minds. And yeah, that wellness center would focus on relationship, not just relationship with themselves or with the other folks that are part of that center, but also the relationships that folks are ha have with the substances, because I think that there is something to be said about them. There are many things to be said about the medicalization of psychedelics, but one thing that comes to mind for me is that the way that some folks relate to the substance is like, I'm taking this capsule or these capsules, and these capsules are going to do something to me that there's not a lot of intention around like where the capsules come from or where they grow. And of course, like I certainly try to, in our very first session, we talk about the origins of psilocybin in this case, as well as the indigenous use, traditional use, and all that. But I feel like there are limitations for me to say that, as opposed to someone actually experiencing. Whether it's, grabbing the mushrooms and, making a mushroom tea before they drink it, whispering their intention and then drinking it, that there's a different relationship that folks can have with that. So, yeah, if I were to have infinite funds, that's, how I would use them. I don't even know if that is research, or how it would do, what the research would be on, but
But
that's
that's
the
great.
vision of what I.
Yeah, it's a lovely vision. And so if there are any philanthropists watching, get in touch with Sarah. That's I could kind of picture it as you're describing it. So Sarah, thank you so much for doing this. This was a wonderful conversation.
Yeah, thank you so much, Alex. It was a pleasure.